I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head to head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's Clash as we count down to Halloween with King versus King. So on Monday, we were dog sitting a friendly St. Bernard named Cujo. And today, we're getting our cat fixed because that will stop him wandering into the wrong shit, he's dead. Well, there's a fix for that too. Time to visit an ancient Indian burial ground where definitely nothing bad will happen. Repeatedly. From 1989, it's Pet Sematary.
What is this place?
I brought you here to bury Alan's cat.
Daddy, is church all right?
Why, Judd?
I have my reasons.
I dreamed he got hit by a car and you and Mr. Crandall buried him in the pet cemetery.
What did we do tonight, Judd?
What we did, Lois, was a secret.
We'll have a winner at the end of the show, but which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
The Kraken.
Hello, Clash Potters. Today is Thanksgiving Day for cats, but only if they came back from the dead. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilly.
How are you both?
Good.
Very well.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Really enjoying King versus King. Cujo was great on Monday.
What did you think of the shark play?
I loved it. Ian Shaw is, I mean, just he's so good as his father, Robert Shaw. What did you think of it?
I haven't seen it yet, but I will let everyone know on Monday.
Yep. Okay, great, 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 great. Pull back the curtain. Love it. Love it. Set me up, knock me down. You're such a good friend. Such a good freaking friend. Did you like it, V?
The people that I was sat with who were appropriately dressed for the theatre had a really good time. I don't know what you two scruff bags were up to.
Right, very quickly, if you haven't subscribed to us, if you'd be kind enough to do that on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast, it would be massively appreciated by the three of us. And if you are able to give us a little rating and a review, we'd be very grateful. And if you do give us a review, it'll be read out on the show by Chris Tilly, a.k.a. Chris Thrilly, which sounds a bit like this.
Well, we need some fresh reviews.
Oh, really?
Some that aren't weirdly passive-aggressive and nice that I can read out. So I
Vicky stays away from it all. Don't even suggest that they might be passive aggressive.
So I am going to read out an email we got this week. I'm going to read this out verbatim. Hello, love the pod. My friend's boy walked on tiptoes all the time and he ended up having to wear plastic casts on his legs for ages because the heel bone didn't form properly.
Oh my
Keep
God.
Up the great work, Adam.
Oh my God.
Thanks, Adam.
That was,
oh no.
What was that?
That was me talking about Super Nanny, but I can't remember why. Oh, it was Dr. Sleep.
Right.
Danny starts to talk and his mum doesn't make a fuss.
You're not meant to make a big deal out of it and then they'll just stop doing it.
Yeah.
And I said how brilliant it would be if a child just walked on tiptoes. I now take that back, Adam.
Wow.
Yeah, we need some new reviews. Need some new reviews. Okay, these were Victoria's choices this week. Remind us why.
For a little change of pace with the intense, human condition stuff we've been looking at through the other King versus Kings. Yeah.
Scary animals.
Scary animals.
Scary animals. Yes, this October, as we count down to Halloween, we are celebrating the Master of Horror as we pit Stephen King adaptation against Stephen King adaptation. It's King versus King. So, on Monday, Chris was busy dogging. And today, I'm saying, let's go fly a kite next to the most deadly road in cinema history. Let me take you on a journey. Lewis Creed has it all. A beautiful family, a good job as the doctor in a small town, and an idyllic family home, albeit one that is severely lacking a garden fence. Kind of a problem when you live next to Death Highway. And soon enough, Death Highway lives up to its name and the family cat, Church, gets squished. Thank goodness for old man Judd, who tells Lewis there's a way to bring Church back, despite Judd having literally decades of evidence and personal history that this is the worst idea in the world ever. Like, literally not once in Judd's experience have things ended well doing this. So Church comes back from the dead and plays a series of pranks on poor Lewis, making him jump every 10 minutes and interrupting his bath wank with a rat. That doesn't seem to bother Lewis, who follows up one bad idea with another, burying his dead son and then his dead wife in the same place. Even at the very end, as he's making out with his wife's reanimated corpse as pus leaks from her eye socket and she prepares to stab him with a kitchen knife, Lewis refuses to see any problem with his plan, because men just don't listen. Ladies and gentlemen, for your consideration, Pet Sematary. So, histories with this movie. Chris?
So, I guess I saw this when I was 15 and I was watching every horror film. But my memory of this is more through the prism of the 2019 version of Pet Sematary, which I went to see at the cinema at a preview screening. And I was super excited about it. I think being, I don't know, a snob, I was thinking, oh, because it's my era, this one, the effects will be better, the storytelling will be more sophisticated. And then as I was watching it, it was making me remember all the great stuff from the original that I actually preferred. And so it's funny, it made me like the 89 version better watching the 2019 version.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's my history.
I have seen it before, but I was very little, very, very little. I don't know where I was. And all I remember, this is how little I was, I didn't get any of the sort of the human sadness. I just remember the cat getting squashed and being a bit evil and marauding. And that's all I remembered.
I'm the same as you. I think I watched it when I was about 10 years old. Something 10. Ridiculous. And I couldn't remember a single scene from it. And I was asking my brother, I was like, did we watch it together? Maybe. He was like, yeah. And I remember one moment. I'm like, what's that? Remind me of something. He's like,
rat bath.
It's the ankle.
Oh, yeah.
The ankle scene.
Yeah.
We'll get to you, Chris.
Yeah.
We'll come to you for the ankle scene.
Please don't.
You have a funny thing about ankles.
Well, it's Achilles tendons. It's not ankles. It's Achilles
Sorry,
tendon.
That's right.
It's the tendon, man.
It is. It's the Achilles tendon.
You smashed my ankle. That's fine. Misery got no problem with.
Where does this sit on the Hostel scale?
I've never seen the Hostel one, but I've accidentally saw this one this week. I didn't shut my eyes in time. We'll get there.
All right, then let's talk a bit about the production of the movie. So Pet Sematary is the book Stephen King still considers his most terrifying novel. So we were talking about this on Monday and how King gets inspired by real life events. Check out this tick list. He writes the book after he's inspired by moving to a little town called Orrington in Maine. He says, "We rented this nice house on the river. And a pet cemetery was at the back of it. There was a path that went up there that the kids kept mowed. There was also a massive road in front of it, which my son Owen wandered too close to once. And also, his daughter's cat, Smucky, died after being hit by a truck."
Right.
So, as if that wasn't enough, there was an old guy right across the road. The kids were away somewhere, and he was the one who came over and said, "You got a problem with your daughter's cat." And we went over and we looked and it was Smucky. He was on the side of the road and he hadn't been splattered or anything. He looked okay. He was just dead. Then he has a discussion with his wife about whether they tell their daughter, Naomi, about what's happened, or do they say the cat's just gone away?
Mm.
He's just gone off wandering somewhere. And in the end, different to the book, they go, "Yeah, Smucky's dead," which is probably, in King's words, the right thing to do. But they did bury Smucky at the pet cemetery. And that night, after they buried Smucky, they heard their daughter in the garage and she was shouting, "God can't have my cat. That cat is my cat. Let him have his own cat." And King says, "I'll put all of that in the book." Everything in the book, up to the point of the supernatural stuff, is absolutely true. He also says, "I had the greatest time writing the book until I was done with it. And I read it over and I said to myself, this is awful. This is really fucking terrible." And not that it was badly written, but that all the stuff about the death of kids, it was so close to me because my kids lived near that road. I thought, there's such grief in this book. It's just awful. And his opinion hasn't really changed that much over the years, because that was him talking about it, a couple of decades ago. And this is what he says in 2019. "I listened to it last year when I was down in Florida walking on the beach with the dog. Michael C. Hall had done the audiobook. I was curious about it. You know, I hadn't been near it in 20, 25 years. So I listened to it and thought, my God, this is just awful. It's just as dark as can be." Weirdly, though, this is a book that I don't know where this sits on your countdown of the best Stephen King books, but this is a fan favourite of all his books. Have either of you read it?
No,
I haven't either.
Oh.
I really do wish to read it, though, because people talk about it as like, this is a truly terrifying book. He was asked once, "Does it seem strange to you that it's such a favourite among your readers when you find it so abhorrent yourself?" To which he replied, "Well, P.T. Barnum said something like, nobody ever went broke underestimating the taste of the American people. I think that death really is a mystery and people get a kick out of seeing the veil lifted."
And it's also the book that his wife wasn't happy about. You know, that interview, which I've posted on our Twitter in Playboy in 1933, so the year the book was published, but a while after it had been written, he said the particular sequence in it, he says there was the moment when Lewis exhumes his son's body, and he says, "The gas bloated corpse explodes with disgusting belches and farts, a truly ghastly sound and smell that has been described to me in grim detail by mortuary workers and graveyard attendants. It was because of that scene that Tabby didn't want me to publish the book." So and obviously his constant reader, like Tabitha, has a lot of say in what King does and doesn't do. And yeah, that's why it was put off for a while. Was not only was he worried about it, but she said, "You can't publish this."
And there was also, wasn't it a deal that he wanted to get out of with a publishing house, Doubleday? They were screwing him over for money.
Unbelievably, he signed a deal with them. I think they were paying $50,000 a year, which was an incredible deal when he signed it. Mm. But by the time, you know, the early 80s rolled around, he's Stephen King. This is a terrible deal.
Mm.
And they really needed to renegotiate with him and they didn't. So it was a way to get out of that deal. Yeah, he gave them this book, which was a big seller, but really they should have had more foresight, really, because they could still be publishing his books. But yeah, so it had been in a drawer for 5 years, and it was just a make way to get himself out of the deal.
And you're right about, obviously, his wife, Tabitha, because when you read the book, I know we talk about it most weeks, but it's a fantastic book, Stephen King, on writing. He talks about Carrie, I think he was, am I right in thinking?
Yes, he chucked
it
away.
He threw it in the bin. And she fished it out and read it and were like, "What are you doing? This is fantastic." And obviously it went on to be a huge hit.
I think she said, "That's not how periods and tampons work. So we need to work on that. But this is good."
So about the film itself, because that was just about the book. Stephen King wrote the script himself. It was going to be George Romero who was originally going to direct it in the
zombie
mid-80s.
Movie by the Zombie King.
I know. And you sort of read that and you go, it's one of those, what would that have been like?
But you know, George Romero directed a lot of bad films as well as a lot of good films. So,
yeah, and indeed he dropped out, and the script then sits in limbo because apparently there's no interest at that point in the mid-80s in any more Stephen King adaptations. And then just completely by chance, there's a writer's strike in 1988 and they're looking for completed scripts and this is there. And so Paramount go, "Look, it's already written. Let's make this movie." King approves of their choice of director, Mary Lambert, who at that point had one critically but not commercially successful film called Siesta that I will quite happily hold my hands up and say I've not seen.
But you have seen her other work, obviously. She was on the set of Like a Prayer, making that with Madonna when she read the script.
Yeah, she did Like a Prayer, Like a Virgin and Material Girl. She was Madonna's go-to video director.
And she met King for burgers, and she said the reason she got the gig was because She didn't come with an agenda. She didn't want to change stuff. She said, I like what you've done here. You know what you're doing. Let's direct your story.
It's amazing how well that works.
Yeah.
What a skill.
She got the gig, but he lived 20 minutes down the road and he just said, I'm here whenever you need me, which, you know, that can be dangerous, but it's clearly a lovely thing in this instance.
And I think it worked for her over the course of making the film, as we'll get to, because I think there were points in the film where the studio were disagreeing with some of her choices and she found a really good ally in King who backed up a lot of her decisions because they were his decisions.
Yeah.
It sounds fun as well because he plays up to being Stephen King. One of the actors, Dale Midkiff, said that he would often come to set, he'd sit with them all, drink a can of Coke and read out loud from the obituaries, laughing his head off. It's like, you've got to love the man.
His big insistence was that they shoot in Maine, which they did. The film comes out in 1989 and it gets not great reviews. Gets a bit of a drubbing by the critics, but goes on to be a huge hit. $11.5 million budget, nearly $60 million at the box office. And also the Ramones had one of their biggest hits.
I love that song.
It's a great song. Mm. Apparently hardcore Ramones fans don't like it.
No. Yeah.
Is that because it's got a fourth chord and they don't like four chord Ramones song? Because it's a bloody tune.
Yeah, and they did it because Mary Lambert was friends with them and she was like, would you do this? And they were like, yeah, sure. And I think they knocked it out in a couple of days. I don't think they spent long on it.
No, they do their songs in a couple of minutes. That's it. I'm done.
Some people, I was doing a lot of reading around sort of where this sits in the lexicon of Stephen King films, and there's a lot of people that still count this as one of Stephen King's scariest films. Mm-hmm. Those people are wrong. So, shall we get into the film?
Yes.
Any more for any more?
Yeah.
All right. So, we open on the Pet Sematary. And it looks fucking cool. I really like this shot. And I also like the fact that when Pet Sematary comes up on the screen, the T is a crucifix, a gravestone.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty nice. I like things like that. And then I got a little bit tearful, obviously, because I have a dog. But reading some of the messages on the gravestones, you know, there was like, we love you, boy. And Biffa was a great sniffer. And I was like, oh, it made me think of Simon's mortality.
Mm.
And I didn't like that. And that made me a bit sad.
But then you were happy because you remembered he'll probably eat you.
Mm. Yeah, of course. Of course. And then the cycle begins again. Then we met the Creeds. Dad, Lewis Creed. Dad, Lewis Creed, a man who seems to be permanently on Valium, as it takes 5 seconds longer than it should for any emotion to register with his brain. It's an interesting performance from Dale.
Yes.
I don't dislike it. Mm. I find
it's a bit of a grower. Like, at first, you're like, what's happening? But
It's sort of off-kilter. It feels quite kind of, I don't know, it feels almost like, you know, a daytime TV sort
of. Sure.
He feels like a TV guy, doesn't he?
Mm. Yeah.
You feel like you watch a TV actor. And there were a couple of times I thought he was terrible, but then they turned out to be dream sequences. So I thought maybe he's being bad. He's being bad on purpose here.
Yeah. Mm.
But yeah, it's a strange one.
Yeah.
I flip-flopped on him a lot in this one.
I did. In the end, though, I was quite convinced by him. We also meet Mum, Rachel Creed, who apparently once read what smiling was in a book but didn't quite understand it.
Ooh, wow. Wow. That is brutal. Denise Crosby.
I mean, she's quite cold, isn't she? And it doesn't really come across until a little bit too late why she has these hang-ups about death and why she's so stern with Lewis about this subject of death and why she's such a dick to Judd when he brings up death. And by the time you get to the point where you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
She's incredibly underserved by this script.
I think.
Yeah.
And we also have God-hating daughter Ellie, who's played by two twin girls in the film, and son Gage, a.k.a. Dead Meat, who the minute he's left on his own goes wandering towards Death Highway, where trucks are attempting to break the land speed record.
It is because Denise Crosby turns up and he's like, what do you think? She's like, I love it. And then a big truck goes by, you're like, but we can't live here. Yeah. Definitely, we can't live. We've got two kids. There's no fence.
Yeah, oh, build a fence.
Build a massive, massive
you
fence.
You are a doctor. You can afford a fence and a gate, just a wall.
I'd make the kids wait in the car. I'd be like, you don't even get out of the car. We are going back wherever we came from. We're not living here. No way.
It is insane how scary those trucks are. Yeah. Just the way they thunder
by. You can play in the garden, but you will be tethered to a tree by a rock.
Put some reins on it.
And also for me, in that sort of parenting, it's obviously about primarily the safety of the kids, but you have a life to live as well. Do you want to never be able to relax ever again for the rest of your life? Because until they leave home, if they make it to being a teenager, because that's what they're signing up for.
They're not leaving home. They're never leaving the house.
That's true, you're
locking them in that house.
Yeah.
And it's the thing is, like, you see the first truck thunder by and you're like, yeah. Rachel is going to have a problem with that. They're going to have to sort that out. That's got to be the first thing that you do. But if that wasn't bad enough, old man Judd turns up and saves Gage immediately.
Yeah.
As he's wandering, then you're certain.
Yeah.
At that point, there is no question.
But this is not workable.
Seeing a truck is one thing, but then seeing your son saved from within, you've been there less than 5 minutes and you've had to have your son saved by a stranger and you are not going, fence, build a fence. It's insane. But Judd is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, he's very good.
Fred Gwynne is so, in my opinion, he's so good in this film. And it's weird because director Mary Lambert had to fight for him to be Judd in the film because the studio went, Herman Munster, fuck off. Absolutely not. And she was like, no, he's right. And he certainly is.
Yeah, he's perfect.
Because throughout this film, he's so more complex than initially you think he's going to be. Like, and we'll get into him because there's some weird decisions he makes.
Yeah, and just to go back to that remake, I was so excited to see what John Lithgow would do with the role. But then he watches like, yeah, not as good as Fred Gwynne. Mm. Love you, John, but like, it's just something, it's just a magical performance.
It is. So the family immediately ask Judd about where the path at the bottom of their garden goes, and Judd says, that's a good story, that is, and not at all ominous, as you can tell from my tone of voice and the way I'm staring off into the middle distance. And we also meet housekeeper Missy, aka delete these scenes.
Yes. WTF. What is going on there? In fact, we don't even need to talk about it. It's just a thing that happens for no reason.
I don't know. The only thing in my head, I was like, well, Stephen King he's got the cameo as the priest at her funeral. Did he go, no, Missy needs to stay in so I can have my cameo?
You imagine there's a scene somehow connecting her with her death with the larger story.
Yeah.
But no.
No, not at all. I've got one theory. We'll come to it, but it's weak. I'll say that now. It's weak. Anyway, Judd shows the family the pet cemetery and manages to piss off Rachel by mentioning the concept of death to young Ellie. At least I think it pisses her off. It's very difficult to tell. It might just be her resting face. But Ellie is now very concerned about her cat Church dying and directs her anger at God for trying to basically steal her cat. And how God should get his own fucking cat if he loves cats so much. And a lot has been said about God in literature and in cinema.
Mm.
Cat thief is a first for me. The idea that God is a cat thief.
But Stephen King doesn't believe in God. Did he tell his daughter that, what was the cat called? Schmuck? What was he
Schmucky.
Called?
Smucky.
Whatever. That the cat had gone to heaven, because that seems like a bit of a cop-out.
I don't think he did. I think he went, no, he's dead.
And she was like, in heaven, you mean? He's like, that's not what I said.
No. I'm Stephen King.
Yeah, so absolutely not.
Well, I wonder whether it's what his wife was sort of looming in the background. Because, so you've got this cat. And I will say this, it is a beautiful scene where Church is in bed with Ellie, sleeps under the duvet, because my very first cat slept under the duvet with me when I was a kid, and I love that cat a lot. And just in case you have any doubts about how fertile my imagination was as a child, I named that cat Puss. So really thinking outside the box.
My first cat I loved very much, and similarly to you, that cat was a ginger cat and was called Ginger. But she used to sleep on my head.
Yeah,
I loved it. So she would sleep across my head like a big headband.
Yeah,
it was brilliant.
So a lot of love. Did you ever have a cat, Chris?
Yeah, kind of. I'm allergic to animals. And so when I was born, my parents had a cat. They didn't know I was allergic then. And it was one of those things where as soon as the baby came in the house, the cat didn't want to come in the house anymore. The cat wasn't happy.
Yeah, they do that.
Yeah. And so Susie didn't come in the house. So that's why they didn't know I was allergic, because Susie stopped sleeping in the house. She would just come to the house for food. And then when I was about five, Susie killed a fox.
Whoa!
Your cat killed a fox.
So, badass. So they found a dead fox in the garden.
A baby fox, or a full size,
a big fox.
Fantastic, and Mr. Fox.
And Susie had changed forever. So it was obviously had mentally scarred her in some way. So from that point on, you couldn't touch or go or stroke Susie, because she would attack you. She would attack anyone that tried to go near her.
Cujo.
We had the worst pet you could imagine. Didn't come in the house, didn't like to be stroked, and it would attack anyone that dared to touch her.
And it made you sneeze.
And it made me... Well, I never actually experienced that, because I never really touched Susie, and she never came in the house. So, she was a devil cat, poor thing, but she went through a lot.
Mm. It's where Simon goes for squirrels all the time and he's never caught one, which is great, because I met another whippet owner and they were like, if he ever gets one, they get the bloodlust. Mm. And I was like, the what now? Sorry. The bloodlust. Once they've had a taste of squirrel, they'll always want more.
Was it Judd?
Well, there's a good story about that. So thankfully, he's just too stupid to catch a squirrel. I mean, literally, they've been sitting in the middle of a field and I'm like,
go and have one.
Help
yourself.
Nancy's always like, squirrel, get rid of it. I'm like, do nothing.
And have you met a squirrel these days? If you ran at a squirrel, it would run back at you to fight you. They've lost all fear.
There was a squirrel sitting on a fence once when I was filming, and I was just like, oh, look at that squirrel. And I thought, I walked towards it and I got so close and it didn't move.
Yes.
I went, I got the fear. Yep. I was like, yeah, I'm going to leave you alone. I don't know what that... Why haven't you moved?
Yeah,
they're brave. Anyway, Church is getting his nuts cut, which Rachel also has a go at Judd about, using language like that in front of her daughter, because she's doing a great job of ingratiating herself with your new neighbours after you move to a new place. She also forces Lewis to promise
this
that
is mad.
Church won't die.
I will never die. Because
it's it's the Team America line. I will sleep with you if you promise you will never die. I promise I will never die.
Because also, at the end of the film, Mary Lambert said there's we'll get there, but there's a couple of different versions. But basically,
here we go.
This is his great No, listen.
Enjoy it.
Yeah, thanks. I'm just gonna sit back and let it wash over me. Yeah, here we go. So what happens at the end of the film, Victoria?
No, what Mary Lambert said was that she is his great love, which is why he's driven to these extremes, right? Their relationship is good, otherwise he wouldn't bury her. But then when she says in the kitchen, weirdly, doesn't refer to her daughter by name and says, go on, Lewis, give the little girl a promise. That to me is using when a couple in trouble use their kids as weapons, because you're turning your daughter against her father because you're point scoring, which is not a healthy relationship. That's what I read. I was like, this marriage is in trouble.
Do you think so?
100%. You don't do that. You don't say, go on, tell her everything's fine. And because then he's angry at her and he's like, well, you have to explain to her if the cat doesn't make it through the procedure.
Yeah, because, he is furious with her because he's
course.
Like, there is a chance that it won't wake up and then, you're the one who's going to have to do it. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. Point scoring with the kids.
I felt horrible when I got Simon's nuts cut
it's
off.
It's for the best though, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is. But yeah,
where'd you keep them?
Under the stairs. That's what he's going for. Give me them back.
It's absolutely right. That it's the right thing to do, but you do just sort of go, and they don't know, but you do think, you know what I've done, which is why I got mine done at the same time.
I was living with my dad when he took me.
What are you doing to me, Dad?
Well, I remember when you were getting so, you were like, oh, we're going to get a whippet. I was like, all right. Are you going to, like, not that I care about these things, obviously. Are you getting a girl one or a boy one? And you're like, I'm getting a boy cat. I'm getting a cat. I'm getting a man dog. And I was like, of course you're getting a man dog. Mm. And then, but you would have walked into that knowing that you were going to have that procedure done.
Yeah.
I don't feel that sorry for you. You could have got a girl dog.
I know, but it was my
or
first...
a cute dog.
What do you mean?
I don't know why I said that.
Simon is loved universally. He is a beautiful dog. He's a beautiful dog.
He's cuter when I'm pissed.
It's like saying one of Vicky's kids is ugly.
You say it behind my back. You don't say it to my face.
But you just don't expect it. Because it was my first one. You just don't understand the emotional journey that you go on. But he's fine now, and it's much better for him. Anyway, Lewis has a big first day at work after Victor Pascoe, a jogger, is hit and killed. But just before he dies, he knows Lewis's name.
This is so awesome because he's like, tell me, how do you know my name? And the bigger question is, how are you back from the dead? He doesn't seem to care
about
that.
I thought that was the Victor Pascoe thing had happened in the past, and that was like a dream sequence from his previous job.
No, it's his first.
Then he helps
and that's
out
how he knows his name.
No, it's his first day at work. Yeah. It's his first day at work, but it's never explained. I don't know how he knows his name.
I thought that whole thing was a dream.
No.
No, because then Victor helps Rachel, so he's real to her. So she's, they could be having a shared dream, I don't know.
He's definitely real.
In that way.
It's definitely his first day at work, because it's only then that evening where Victor shows him the pet cemetery, takes him for that walk. But Brad Greenquist is the guy who plays Pascoe. He's great.
He's good.
Mm. I really like him. I get sort of slight American Werewolf in London vibes.
Yeah, exactly right. Definitely.
It's exactly the same. Yeah. It's played with the same tone as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, he shows Lewis the place beyond the cemetery and is all like, this is the place that the dead talk. Don't go to the place where the dead walk. Nice line. Like that line. But no sooner than you say that, Church gets hit by a truck and old man Judd is taking Lewis there to get the cat brought back. Can we please talk about Judd's decision here?
Sure.
What is he thinking?
Well, I think what he's actually thinking, because he says it at some point later on, is he just couldn't, he's really bonded with Ellie and he couldn't bear the pain that she would go through. So he took Lewis to the cemetery. But then because he's so malevolent as an actor and he's got that weird dual thing where it's like, is he a goodie? Is he a baddie? I thought he was doing it on purpose because I read too much. I was like, you're back from the dead and you need fresh meat or whatever to like keep this thing going.
You thought it was about Judd?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was very surprised when he wasn't an actual corpse.
Spot his dog has died. He's got that story backed up for later about the World War II.
Oh, yeah.
A soldier who comes back, who they have to burn alive. And he's like, yeah, let's take the cat there. Sure. Yeah.
I think he's a good man, but the pet cemetery is doing it to him.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
And certainly King has spoken about that in the past.
Yeah, he says
that's the way the sort of evil part of the cemetery works on you. He's doing it out of love, but he doesn't realise that it's a bad thing he's doing. I found one quote where someone said, is there a malevolent side to what Judd does? He says he knows better. I had to get that in the book where he says something like, you do things, you think they're good things, but something gets a hold of you, you know, and that's this evil part of the cemetery.
Yeah, but also like Vicky says, Stephen King goes, you find Judd kind of falls in love with the family. And of course, that's the evil part of the cemetery and the way it works on you. As John Coffey says in The Green Mile, he killed them with their love. And that's what Judd does. Done out of love. Yep. He's not evil. He's not malevolent. And also in the films, in the film itself, in the script, taking it away from, you know, what Stephen King says in his interviews, Judd actually says, a man doesn't always know why he does some things. Try harder, Judd. think on this. What's happened before.
The quote, what is it? Because I sometimes find it hard to track what he was saying. The soil of a man's heart is stonier. Is that what he says?
Yes.
What does that mean?
No, you
don't know. Okay.
I don't know. I sort of went, yeah.
Sure, it is.
Fine. Still probably don't bury a cat there, but fair enough. Anyway, Lewis is all like, has anyone ever buried a person up there? And I love this turn of phrase, which I'm going to start using. Christ on his throne, no.
Yeah, that was excellent.
That's a great line.
Especially when he turns out to be lying as well. Like, he seems genuinely shocked and he's lying.
Anyway, Church the cat is back and he is a massive dick, which can be kind of hard to tell with the cat.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, there's no change. That is just a cat.
That's your... No, you've had a bad experience with Susie. That's what Susie was like. Some cats
aren't
like that.
Twinkle's lovely. Twinkle acts a bit like a dog, my cat now. So she will lie on the rug on her back with her paws in the air. She doesn't want a tickle or anything like that. She's just really, really relaxed and really happy to be in your company. She's actually quite a little bit too needy, to be honest, which for a cat is unusual. So she's all over you all the time.
Oh, really? Like, yeah. I want strokes.
She wants strokes. She wants attention, talking to, all sorts.
That's like Simon. We should put them together.
Yeah.
He'd eat her. So, yeah.
She's smelly and she looks dishevelled. Again, a bit like us the morning after the live podcast.
Because honestly, I mean, So church doesn't really do anything a cat wouldn't normally do. Like chucking a dead rat in a bath.
I don't think they'd do that.
They definitely deliver dead rodents.
Yes, they do.
I mean, I'm just sad we don't get to see the shot of the cat throwing it, lobbing it.
That's true.
That would be funny.
I wondered, this is why I thought maybe Judd thought it would be okay to bury the cat there, because he's like,
just a cat.
You won't be able to tell. Like, people, yes, dogs, sure, but a cat, we'll get away with this. So yep, we'll take it up there. Then Missy kills herself. Moving on.
Cheers, Missy.
Do you have any theories about the importance of this? I guess the only thing is because it leads on to another conversation. Ellie becomes more obsessed with death and wanting to know about heaven, and is asking her dad a lot of questions about what happens after you die.
I thought Missy, because she's got constant pain and she doesn't want any help with it, and like in her stomach. And I thought she was a reanimated corpse, and so it got, and that was the price she'd paid.
How many characters did you think weren't reanimated corpses in this movie?
So that's what I thought it got her. She's like, oh, I've reached the end of what I can endure.
Because it was cancer, wasn't it? In the note she leaves, she says, I have cancer. I'm sorry.
I missed that.
Yeah, the handwriting was terrible.
I know. She was in a state, though.
I think we're just wasting time on Missy.
I think it's worth a mention, though. I just wanted to see if there was anything out there about Missy.
Maybe in the book.
So we get our Stephen King cameo. I do remember this as a kid.
It's a good cameo.
It's a great cameo.
He's such a scary looking man. I'm sorry, but he is. And he just gets more scary the thinner and older he gets.
Of that cameo, he said, I like the people that I was working with. And yeah, man, I wanted the screen credit too. I did. I figured somebody's going to fuck this up. And it's going to be me.
Wow. Don't tell Mary Lambert.
Now we sort of get a little bit more about why Rachel is the way she is. Because we get these flashbacks to her sister Zelda, who has spinal meningitis. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this? Does this fall into the category that we were talking about last week with Gerald's game?
Yes and no.
Yes and yes.
Okay, shall we do yes and no first, and then yes and yes?
Yeah, go on.
Well, yes, because it's othering what is a normal illness and making it into something evil. Mm. So that's ridiculous.
Yep.
But as I say, in the defence of it, I think this isn't what happened to this person. This is her memory of what happened when she was left alone. And so we're not dealing with reality when we're seeing those visions.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. I was really furious.
Yeah, agreed.
After Gerald's game, I was like, what's wrong with you, man? Like, stop doing this. But then Lewis says to his wife, Zelda probably would have been crazy because she was locked in the attic for her whole life.
Yeah, he's diagnosing that from a long way away.
Yeah. I just thought it was so off. And I also think casting a man as Zelda is a dick move as well, to make to make Zelda look in some way off. To your eyes, to cast a man, I think I hate even saying this, but I think we're meant to think Zelda is a monster because she doesn't even look like a woman. And I'm not into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, that's what Rachel says. I mean, I sort of read it as more about the fact that the parents left her at home to look after a very sick sister with no help. And, you know, being a young child, that probably scared her because, you know, this was her sister, but she was, you know, struggling to eat, struggling to swallow. She was choking on her food, and having to deal with all that as a child must have been kind of hard. But yeah, I agree. I think it was Mary Lambert's decision to cast a man because, and she actually says, it would be weirder and scarier.
See, that's not good, is it? I don't know. I can't quite figure out why I don't like it, but I just didn't.
Yeah, I vaguely remember these scenes as a kid, and I do remember them being quite scary, though. Just the way they're shot and the way comes towards camera.
It's a terrifying scene.
Yeah.
So Rachel tells Lewis this whole story, and Lewis, having heard it,
at this point, I was like, that is the man for me. Are you a bit sad? Do you want a Valium? Yeah, do actually.
I mean, that's what he says. He's like, I'll get you one of my, I mean, the Valium. I'll get you one of the Valium. I'm not taking it every day. Shut up. His other big takeaway from the story, having heard all this, he goes, amazing. Now I have a really good reason to hate your parents. Oh, <yeah. laughs> It's like, thank you for sharing that.
I love the fact that when she says, she goes, you know, I don't take Valium. And he's like, you do tonight. And like, that hits a lot of points for me. Like, I like being bossed around in that way. I like being told what to drink quite a lot. So if someone was like, you're having a Valium, I'd be like, brilliant. Let's get married.
And then we get the big scene. Gage's death. Truck driver shooting along the road, blasting out some Ramones.
Yeah.
Pedal to the metal, boys.
Yeah.
And Gage wanders into the road.
Sheena is a punk rocker. Gage is a flat kiddie. That's what you should be singing.
It's quite a powerful scene. It's a really well done death. The shot of the truck coming towards the camera from almost Gage's point of view as the last shot, and then just the shoe.
Oh, it's awful. But also, talking about Mike Flanagan again, like, notice how much more powerful it is, because the actual shot of Gage being flattened by a truck is left to your imagination, and that's worse. So you don't need to see a kid being killed frame for frame.
You haven't let that go, huh?
No, I'm really mad about it.
Still mad about it. Still mad about that. Wow.
Because doesn't that show you, though? Because I know you didn't like the scene, but you didn't mind it, and you thought it was brave and all the rest of it. And I'm not being mean to you. I'm just saying, but when you watch this, you could have shown the kid go under the wheels and all the rest of it, but
the circumstances are so different. Not even I want to see a child explode on the bumper of a truck. I'm not like that sick.
Okay.
And my problem with the Dot Sleep one was more about watching being tortured at length.
That's why. Me too.
I think you could have shown the... I wouldn't have been against them showing the kid getting hit by the truck.
Ooh.
But this was very effective.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant scene.
Do you think this is because you've got kids and we don't?
I don't know. I mean, I think, and it's not just me. It's like Stephen King. There's a reason why he's got kids, and his kid ran in the road, and everybody's kid runs in the road at some point. And it is the absolute worst feeling you've ever felt in your whole life. Mm. And then you torture yourself with these things. I torture myself with these things constantly, which is probably says more about me. But it's just one of those things that it could happen so easily. It often almost happens all the time, and then there it is in front of you. Mm. So it's really horrific for that. It's not as horrific, weirdly, as I thought, as the funeral afterwards, because the truck scene, I think a lot of people with kids have played that out in their head, and so that's in there. But the funeral just adds more fuel. I've never imagined that.
It's a shock. it's a shock.
Yeah, get a lead. Like, you're not allowed to walk sighthounds off a lead on a road, because if they see something, they'll run for it.
Yeah.
And I saw a whippet with its owner just trotting up behind him, not on a lead the other day. And I was like, I hate you. How have you managed to do that?
Oh, because he's so well trained.
Because he's trained a whippet to not, like, but the most hysterical I've ever seen Nettie was when Simon ran into the road. He, like, was chasing a puppy out of the, we were in the park, and he ran into the road. Ooh. And the sound, like, she made, it was like, I was like, oh my God, what is that noise?
Yeah.
Well,
it was awful.
Was it like Lewis here?
No! And we'll continue after this break.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, like, have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Yeah, that's a big moment. He delivers that well.
It's also because, you know, the torturing yourself stuff is, it's not Gage's fault, it's only Little. It is Lewis's fault for making the move to that stupid house.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. But that funeral scene. Mary Lambert talks about it. She was like, Stephen was my ally in keeping this scene in there. The studio wanted to take it out. They felt it was too sad and it took away from the scariness of the film, but Stephen was very supportive at that point in terms of saying no, he thought the elements were important.
It's quite weird tonally, that scene, but I think that works because it would be a surreal moment.
Yeah.
This would play out surreally. You could believe that happening in this situation, and it would play out in quite a strange way.
And just so, you know, there's so many social conventions around funerals and weddings and things like that, and to have a fist fight with your father-in-law because he's so grief-stricken is the worst thing imaginable.
And no one knowing how to react is exactly how it would be.
Yeah,
I mean, so the father-in-law, Irwin, from Chicago, I mean, I watched it and I was like, you're a massive shit to Lewis. I mean, sure it's your grandson, I get that, but it's his son as well. And he clearly does not like the state of Maine, doesn't Irwin, because he goes, I told you when you moved here, you'd have all the grief in the world. Which is like, oh, really? Is Maine famous for its grief?
Does he not just mean the death road? Like, you can't move there.
Do you think so?
Maybe. If I was a grandparent, that would freak me out. I'd never be able to relax again.
Yeah, but they've never been to the house, have they? Because they refuse to leave Chicago because they hate Maine. And then he doesn't stop there. He goes, I hope you rot in hell, you stinking shit, you killer of children, plural.
That's true, yeah.
He's done what now? Is there something else going on here? And then after that, after Lewis has finally had enough and pushes him over, he has the audacity to pull that expression on his face like, do you see what he did? he pushed me over. Yeah. He pushed me over after I called him a stinking shit and a killer of children. Of course he fucking did, mate.
The killer of children, yeah.
But the coffin falling over and you're seeing the little hand.
Oh, that's bad. Good bad.
Little blue hand.
I really like this scene. I thought it was a great scene.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, obviously, Rachel and Ellie go off to stay with Grandma and Granddad, leaving Lewis to start thinking thoughts best not thought. And Judd tells him, sometimes dead is better. Which is an interesting theme that runs through the film. King talks about this idea of sometimes dead is better. It's about anybody who's ever had to deal with a lingering illness or a relative that won't let go. Sometimes the desire to live is just a biological thing and it's better when it's over. Everybody's dealt with that, you know. You deal with it with your parents, your grandparents, and at some point you have to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's his theory about a lot of the themes in this film and whether you should just go, well, that's that.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite work when it's a kid.
Well, I think that's the point. Because he is right that there are circumstances. Well, everyone would connect with that in some way, but but never when it's a baby. Like, yeah, there's just no way.
And that's why it's an interesting choice making Lewis a doctor. So he's someone who deals with death on a daily basis and should be able to cope with this. But all bets are off when it's your own child.
Mm. There are numerous discussions online, and it does fit into this part of the film that perhaps there is a crossover because, as we were saying with Cujo, there's a crossover the dead zone and. Whether this is a crossover with the Shining universe, because there is this idea that perhaps Ellie and maybe even to a certain extent Rachel have the Shining, because more than once they seem to know what is going on back home in Maine when they're over in Chicago.
Ellie basically knows everything. Mm. It's framed as a dream, but she's like, I know Victor's last name. I know everything.
Well, this is where he's starting to build the shared universe. I think Castle Rock appeared in the first time in Dead Zone, and then it's obviously come back over and over again. And yeah, there's so many characters in the King universe that have a form of what he termed Shining.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've got no doubt that that's what's happening here.
Because Rachel tries to phone Lewis, can't get hold of him while she's standing in front of the scariest painting ever seen in a film.
Yeah.
That kid with the cat.
So I wanted to know, because then Gage is dressed up like that later. Mm. So I wanted to know who it was. And I ended up on Reddit, which is quite unusual for me. Mm. It's meant to be Zelda. So this is what people think.
Okay.
So that's a painting of Zelda before she was confined to the attic. Mm. And then when Gage, because it is quite shocking that he would go on this rampage, he's supposed to be inhabited by Zelda and getting her revenge on Rachel.
Well, that was a big part of American portraiture in that era, because children died young. The mortality rate was high. You would have a painting done of your child when they're 2 or 3 years old so you could remember them in case they did die. Mm. And so she said that was the darkest thing I could imagine, so I had to put it in the film.
Yeah.
And she certainly found a creepy version, didn't she? That frigging top hat.
And now we find out that Lewis has probably gone a little bit mad.
Yeah.
Because he's digging up his son, Gage, and he has a plan at this point, but it's when the police drive through the graveyard and they don't spot him with a searchlight and he just laughs like a maniac. Yeah. And you're like, oh, you've gone over the edge.
Which is good, because you're questioning the choices because you saw what happened to the cat. And so you know it's not going to end well, Lewis, at this point. And also you've gone to dig up your son under cover of daylight, which I think is a mistake.
Yeah, while all this is going on, Judd is eating a gherkin and peanut butter sandwich, which I immediately made myself after seeing
it. Is that what I was eating? That sounds amazing.
Never had one before. So I've had peanut butter and lettuce, which has been a staple of mine. Peanut butter and gherkin.
Sounds lovely.
It's next level shit. Trust me. If you have one takeaway from Pet Sematary, peanut butter and gherkin sandwiches. You're not convinced, Chris?
No.
You're one of those that you don't like mixing salt, sweet and savoury, do you?
Not really.
And you don't like fruit in things, like a salad?
Yeah, or on a pizza. Fruit on my pizza.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Mm, okay. So Rachel travels across country to get back and see what the hell is going on. And she has the help of ghost Victor Pascal. While the force, the evil of the burial ground, tries to stop her. Again, this is a theme that isn't really fully explored. In the book, it is. Stephen King did lots of research about the Wendigo and this idea of what this force sort of reaching out from beyond it. But I don't know, it just gives her a flat tire. And then she gets a lift from a truck driver who, you know, she's in a rush. Because if a truck driver goes, hop in, babe, you're probably going to go, I'll wait.
Yeah, I did wonder if she sort of hopped out of the truck, like wiping her mouth a bit, like I fucking had to. I didn't want to.
And we're into the climax and we get some proper good old-fashioned 80s gore. I love this era of cinema. Evil Gage is back, and in one of the movie's most memorable scenes, he slices Judd's Achilles heel with a scalpel, Chris. Yeah.
You could say that scenes like that are my Achilles heel.
You really hate it, don't you? Is it, what is it about?
It's because you've injured your Achilles tendon.
Yeah, but I'm trying to think. I think I had this issue before I had bad Achilles.
Right.
So that's, maybe I brought that on myself, the bad Achilles. Maybe it's in my head. But yeah, there's just something about that tendon getting sliced. Really upset. Really upset. Even saying it's making me feel upset. And I always close my eyes, but I didn't close my eyes in time this time. And it was really hard to see it.
And it's pretty funny.
And it was on screen long enough that I should have known when it was exposed. Mm. That bit of his foot.
Oh, bugger. Yeah. It's the, I couldn't think of another reason why he's wearing slippers on this mission. And I was like, well, you've got to get that Achilles heel out. But I find it worse when he gets sliced across the lips by the scalpel.
Mm.
That does it for me. Did you ever, I think it was one of the Jackass movies where they're just doing horrible things. Steve-O goes into a room and they've got sheets of A4 paper.
No.
And they start off by running them between their fingers. Mm. So that little webbing that you have between the fingers. And then they do it to Steve-O and they run it across the corners of his mouth and cut them open with the paper.
No.
That's from the film Swimming with Sharks. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Where Kevin Spacey plays an evil film producer and his assistant ends up holding him hostage. And the first thing he does to talk to him is with paper cuts because of all the paper cuts he's got working for him. That's from that film. And it is one of the most horrific scenes in film history that also plays quite funny.
Yeah.
Especially now.
The Jackass scene, they did for real though. And the best thing is, Steve-O's last line after he sort of had his mouth sliced open in the corners, he just sort of walks out and he goes, glad I came in this room. It's funny. And then Gage hasn't finished. He bites out Judd's throat. Brilliant.
So they had to, because that's really the kid. How they did that was they had to teach that kid how to pretend to bite. And so he learned how to pretend to bite. And so he's really got his jaws clamped on Fred Gwynne's neck, but he's pretending to bite. And Fred Gwynne really sells it.
Yeah.
You think he's getting his throat ripped out.
You'd have to, because Gage is still only about 2 years old and Judd is a big man. And there's a part of you, it's one of the funniest / most brilliant things I've ever seen, but it is unbelievable that he can't just chuck his two-year-old across the room because he's two, even if he is a demon hell baby or whatever. But yes, Judd does a very good job of making you believe that he's got superhuman strength.
Yeah. Mm. And then Rachel, it turns out, has done 100% Mr. Halloran from The Shining, where she has travelled across country on various different forms of transport, gets there and gets killed immediately.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's proper.
I bought you something, Mummy.
I couldn't believe a little shit turned on his mum.
And he's wearing the velvet outfit and the top hat, isn't he, from the portrait? Like, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
And it's that, I tell you what it is, it's that little child voice and the laughter. Mm-hmm. It's very upsetting to have that turned around into something evil. What is the most beautiful, innocent sound in the world?
But that's the thing. I think about this a lot. Like, the children, when they're in their bedroom, if they want to get up in the night, I know everyone talks about this, and come into our room, they are allowed to do that. But we've got, like, blackout blinds, so you are so asleep, and then all of a sudden you just hear, Mummy! And it's like, fucking hell! And your first instinct isn't, oh, the child. It's like, get whatever that is away from me.
Yeah. Why do you need to watch horror movies when you can wake up at 3 a.m. and find a child standing over you?
Yeah.
Blackout blinds are great, though.
I know, but because we didn't have them in the other room, so now we're sleeping really deeply. So when they wake me up, I am not nice to them.
I love the fact that Church is looking on through all this, really egging him on.
Yeah.
Classic. That's classic Church.
Yeah, and it's really good work. I think it maybe owes a little bit of a debt to Child's Play, which I couldn't believe came out the year before. Mm. I thought Child's Play was much later, but it was 1988 the first Child's Play came out. And the work with the doll that they do.
It's very similar. I mean, there would have been, they would have been making this before Child's Play came out. So it wouldn't be copying, but it does look like Chucky several times.
It's just, but it's really good. Because the way the doll moves when it sort of is like just sort of, because it's clearly just been thrown out of the attic at her, but it just looks like this child's just leapt straight at her without thinking about how it's going to get to her. It's great.
But you really have to suspend your disbelief when it's clearly a doll in a way that you didn't, I think, in Cujo.
But I quite love, I think some, as long as it's not CGI, as long as it's still a practical real world in camera effect, sometimes the weirdness of having a doll there actually accentuates the weirdness of the scene.
Well, interestingly, have you watched the remake of Pet Sematary?
No.
For the 2019 version, they make it the sister that dies rather than the boy. Yeah, and I think it was simply so that they could get an actor, so they get someone to act rather than trying to make a toddler do things. Mm. And I think it was very hard for them to get this child to do certain things, and you don't want to upset the child or scar them. And so, I think it works fine. I know fans of the book were upset about that change, but it doesn't really make that much of a child is still a child. And Stephen King had absolutely no problem with it. He completely understood why you would do that for a movie version, because sometimes you need an actor and then you don't have a Chucky issue.
And talking about the way that Gage delivers a line and the actor delivers the line, is there any better moment than when he gets injected with the poison eventually by Lewis?
Oh, my God.
It's so good.
No fair.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh.
But also, you feel sorry for him because
you do.
When his dad injects
really
him,
sorry for him,
he screams like a 2-year-old, 3-year-old would. And if you were Lewis, you'd be like, oh, God, I'm really sorry. I can't believe I've just done that. Mm. But you have to. But it's very good.
Yeah, I mean, they both sell it there, but it's incredible. He's pure evil, and yet it's just an impossible thing to watch.
Yeah.
A little child being euthanized.
It's clever that he sort of almost knows that that his last action is going to be to guilt trip the fuck out of his dad by going, no fair, you cheated by bringing a syringe with you.
Mm. Yeah. Cutie.
And yet, Lewis will still not learn.
he waited too long with Gage, it'll definitely work, as Rachel's only just died.
This fucking guy. So, yep, he's hauling Rachel up to the burial ground, comes back, as you do, sits down for a game of solitaire by the fridge. and then Rachel comes back. So, the ending here, there were two different endings for the movie, and the ending in the book was also kind of different. So the book ends with Lewis playing solitaire in the house, waiting. He hears the door open, footsteps behind him. He draws the Queen of Spades, and then behind him, the reanimated Rachel puts a cold hand on his shoulder and with a voice, in quote marks, full of dirt, simply says, "Darling." And that's how it ends.
Good.
So the original ending in the movie was also more ambiguous. The Rachel, undead Rachel, came back into the kitchen where Lewis is playing solitaire, but it leaves it at that. She just comes in and you're not sure. It's slightly more ambiguous. Mm. Lambert said this was a more spooky, sad and tragic ending because the audience knows it's not going to be what he wants. She's not coming back as his wife, but it's not clear what's going to happen. The studio said, absolutely not. We want it reshot and a lot more graphic. So they did all the gruesome effects with prosthetics, and she kills Lewis, and as is alluded to by the scream over the fade to black.
Yeah, I watched an interview with her on the Blu-ray, and she said the studio notes were, we want some black humour, we want a pow, and we want to send people out with a smile on their face. Which, I mean, it kind of, it's funny, isn't it? Especially when he's tonguing her.
Yeah.
Like, it's not very believable.
Oh, shit. Pussy weeping eyes. She's got one as well in this. That was another connection with Cujo.
Yeah, yeah. I don't really buy him French kissing her.
No.
When she walks in
but
like
he's
that.
Mad at this point. He's lost it.
Yeah.
And, you know, she still looks all right.
Any port in a storm.
So that's pretty much it. Mary Lambert had a sequel idea that didn't get made. She did direct Pet Sematary 2, but it wasn't the original version she wanted to make. She wanted to make a story where Ellie, who clearly lives out her teenage years until she's an adult with grandpa and grandma in Chicago, decides to return to Maine to find out what happened to her parents. Lambert says, we don't know exactly what happened to Lewis and Rachel. I think it probably would work out best if the body was one of them, if one of them was found and the other was presumed destroyed in the fire, but they actually survived wandering around in the woods. So I was leaning towards Lewis just because of the Lewis Ellis connection. That didn't get made. They made a different version with Edward Furlong in that Lambert did direct. King had his name taken off, and I haven't seen.
No, I can't remember if I've seen it or not. I think in the new film, you end up with Lewis, Rachel and Ellie all zombified and sort of marching towards Gage, who's still human at the end.
Oh, wow.
And that's that was quite a fun ending. And what I will say about that remake is it loses the campy tone. There's definitely a campness to this that they got rid of, which is fine. And the other thing I remember is Victor Pascal is not played for laughs at all. He's played for scares. Mm. It's fine, but this is definitely the superior version.
So yeah, when he was asked about the remake in 2019, and indeed the fact that there were a lot of King movies getting made, Stephen King says, what happened, I guess, was that it was such a big success that people decided, well, there must be gold in some of that old shit. as I said on Monday, I did check. No animals were harmed in the making of this. The rat was dead. The cat was dead. And the cat that is put to sleep was put to sleep by a veterinarian.
So yeah, because it is definitely a dead cat on the road. So I was like, have they got the cat?
It's a fake cat.
Oh, good.
It's a fake.
Because it looked a lot like a real dead cat.
It looked really good, but it's not. It's not. So we're fine. We're all good. Shall we do the bits?
Mm.
All right then. Victoria, best scene.
Gage getting killed by the truck.
Why?
Because it's just so powerful and weirdly tastefully done and memorable and horrible, and it chills you and thrills you and whatever. Not too much, just enough kind of thing.
Chris?
I was frightened to pick that. So I'm going for what you mentioned. It's when Gage walks away saying no fair and then falls over. I watched that over and over again, trying to figure out how they did that. And also just hearing him say no fair, it's really freaky.
No fair.
And I think they played it backwards, the scene where because he walks into the wall, like smacks himself. Mm. And I think that was him getting up and walking. So so the way that it's kind of off, I don't know, all that stuff with Gage is really engaging.
Nice.
It's just, I don't know, it's him walking around the house killing people and it being a two-year-old doing it in some scenes. It's like, this is amazing. I've never seen anything like it before. It's probably wrong, but I'm really enjoying it.
It's actually hard to believe. Miko Hughes is the child actor, and it's hard to believe that that is the same kid that you saw early on in the movie, because he is so... terrifying at the end, and so composed.
He's like angry face.
There's a stillness about him, but like the look in his eyes is one of just glee at the torture he's inflicting on these people.
Yeah,
I wasn't afraid to pick the same one as Vicky. It's Gage's death by the truck. Mm-hmm. It's an impressive and moment. Right then, most valuable whatever, Chris.
Well, if it's whatever, I'll say the creepy kid in the top hat in the painting on the wall. That is a very valuable kid. But equally, we talk about kids. Mary Lambert is the one who says that Gage is the reason the film works. And people loving Gage is the reason the film works. So she said Miko Hughes, so I'm going to go with her.
Okay, Victoria?
Same. Mm. Yeah, just when he's growling at the end, like, how do you get him to do it? Like, he was like 27 months when he filmed it. You can tell a 27-month-old to do stuff, but it doesn't mean they will do it. And so you go, like, you know, it's a film, it's expensive. $11 million was a lot of money back then. And you're like, okay, go, snarl. And he just does. Like, that's crackers to me. He's so good at it.
Yeah, but also you can see that watching it, you can see that they were true to their word in that he's not in any scene where something bad is happening, like physically.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of cutaways to some of the weird, awful stuff. So I think they hopefully managed to keep some of that horror away from him.
Although I think a couple of weeks afterwards he did bite someone's throat out. So
that's how Fred Gwynne died.
Well, I've got the same as you. I've written down two because, you know, I'm a dickhead like that. But I've got Fred Gwynne as Judd because I think he deserves a mention, because I think he's just so good in this. But also Miko Hughes as Evil Gage is probably one of the scariest child performances I've seen.
And he ended up having a career as well. He was in Kindergarten Cop, Apollo 13, Spawn. He was the kid in Mercury Rising with Bruce Willis.
Oh.
He's on the poster for Wes Craven's New Nightmare. So he ended up being a good actor.
Mm.
Because obviously, just because he can do things when he's told when he's 2.5 years old doesn't mean you're an actor. But yeah, he grew up to be a proper actor.
Not that you're going to come to regret this moment, but I have just written down Mercury Rising as a film we should do. I haven't seen it in years. And I remember thinking, this is terrible. We're going to have to do it.
I mean, we could do a whole Bruce Willis season of terrible, couldn't we?
Yeah. That was the period where he made a lot.
Not the straight to DVD ones either. The ones that got cinema releases.
Yeah.
Colour of Night.
Fine then. Victoria, change.
So you've already said it, which is weird, because it's what Mary Lambert said, but it really is my change. So I don't think you should remake the film in 2019. I think you should do a film that follows up what happens to Ellie, because her whole family are dead. And she just went to stay with grandma and granddad, and she loves her little brother, and her dad, the moron, has taken his eye off the ball that he's got actually another kid that he should be thinking about, brings her mum back to life, and then they both die. So how would that affect her? So she goes back, and she's either like a big scary monster herself because of all these terrible things, or she's lovely, or whatever. But that's the thing I would like to see.
Yeah, I'd watch the shit out.
I can't find the quote, but I think there was something about the studio, because I think she was going to be sort of a teenage Ellie, sort of a late teen when she came back in this idea for the movie, and the studio were just like, we're not sure about a female teenage lead in this movie.
Great.
And yeah, which is why Edward Furlong got cast in
it. Perfect.
I think the tagline for Pet Sematary 2 is,
we hate girls.
Raise some hell. Not a bad tagline. What's your change?
It's not good.
Okay.
But just trying to come up with an alternative ending, because I feel like this ending's a bit off. I think Lewis has done the wrong thing, both morally and legally. So I think it'd be fun to have the film end with him getting done for Gage's scalpel murders.
Okay. They've been carted off at the end by the police. Mm. Handcuffed.
Mm.
Okay. Okay. I've done mine already. Bye-bye, Missy. That's it. Just don't need her in there. Which is a shame because she's a really,
really
good
actress. Yeah,
she's great in the bit she's in. It's just like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Right then. Any more for any more?
No.
All right, let's do the verdict.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
These were your choices, V.
Yeah, they were. I can't tell. I don't think I can tell. Don't know. All right, so Alex, go first.
Okay, I enjoy both of these. But despite it overflowing with too many ideas, not all of which make sense, I think there are enough great moments and interesting images and a sense of dread that Pet Sematary is the clear winner for me this week. I'm keeping it brief. Cujo's a good film. I enjoyed it, but only after 40 minutes in, and all the potboiler stuff at the start, get rid of that. So, yeah, Pet Sematary for me. And also, a dog doesn't die, so it gets double points.
Very nice. What about you?
So I'd say Pet Sematary is the quintessential Stephen King movie in terms of the theme, the script that he wrote, the location, even cameos in it. You can't get more King than Pet Sematary. But I also really enjoyed Cujo. I think it's a really fun, tight, enjoyable film, but I struggled to come up with a favourite scene in Cujo. Conversely, while Pet Sematary had more bad scenes, I think, than Cujo, it also had more good scenes. So many that I really struggled to narrow it down to a best scene in Pet Sematary. So for hitting the highs that Cujo couldn't quite reach and being about something that actually properly, genuinely got under my skin, I'm going Pet Sematary too.
Pet Sematary is the winner. And I'm thinking Victoria's going the same way, but I will leave it to you.
I feel like she's
going to,
don't you?
Yeah, just it's not the fault of the film, but I thought Cujo was going to be a dog from hell and he's just a poorly dog. And so I didn't feel as... I couldn't get on board with like, yeah, get this dog as much as I
would
like to.
These are words I will say I never thought I'd hear Vicky say.
Because this whole animal thing is a lie. I am not conforming to your lie of me. I'm sorry about that.
It's fine. It's fine.
Anyway, so in Pet Sematary, which is just very, very funny as well. I like the themes. I like the idea. Like, what would you do if the worst thing you could ever imagine happens to you? What would you do to keep your family together? It's really funny and it's really horrible. And after I'd watched it, I was like, I think I'm going to put this in my top 15 films of all time because it was, I just didn't remember it. And I just had so much fun watching it.
Sorry, so this is in your top 15 films of all time?
I think it doesn't nudge the top 10, but let's be serious for a second. But I think
1989's Pet Sematary.
It's in your top 15. Yeah. This is amazing.
It might be number 15. Every so often we do a film on the podcast,
yeah,
which I wasn't expecting to love as much as I end up loving it.
You say quite a lot, though. They're in your top 10 now. So I'm wondering how big your top 10 is at this point.
Yeah, I would hate to be pressed on it. Don't do it now.
Because Rosemary's Baby got in it, didn't it?
Rosemary's
recently?
Baby went to the top 5.
Did Misery get in it?
No.
Something recently did as well.
Rosemary's
it?
Baby.
Is it The Relic?
the toughest man in the world.
That was good.
Free Jack?
Yeah.
It was Free Jack.
So top 15. I just thought it was so much fun.
Lovely.
It's so daft.
That's great.
You know, you talked about like, oh, what's that film called that I hated? Dog Soldiers, was it? But you're like, it's a film to watch when you're pissed with your mates. Like, this is classic that. So much fun.
Agreed.
Yeah.
It's a joy.
Pet Sematary.
3-4-3 for Pet Sematary this week. I thought it might have been closer than it was.
So we've done 3 Stephen King pairings, and I think all of them have been 3-3 in terms of our votes.
That's true.
These are whitewashes.
Oh, yeah.
I flip-flopped on Gerald's game in the end. Yeah, after...
It's 3 whitewashes. What is going to be next week? Will it be 4-4? Well, no, wait, you can reveal the films.
I'm going to reveal the films. Thanks.
He's queuing
you up. I just set you up.
I know you are. So, my choices for our final Halloween countdown show of King versus King. I gave you a clue.
I'm guessing no one has figured these ones out.
He saved the best to last. And a clue, there will be a certain obligatory reference next week. So, the movies next week are, of course, the 1990 It TV miniseries starring Tim Curry versus 2017's It Chapter 1 and 2019's It Chapter 2. Ladies and gentlemen, Clash Podders, near and far, that is over 8 hours of movie watching in preparation for next week's show. But that
punishing.
Is your homework. You best do it. The 1990 version is available all over the place. Amazon, Apple, and the remakes are available on Amazon as well. I don't think they're on Netflix.
No,
you are going to have to purchase these. But
or rent what? Them.
Or purchase them through renting. Rent them through a purchase. Purchase means renting as well, Chris.
You always make this more complicated than it needs to be.
That just reminds me. At the end of Pet Sematary, Judd is doing his sermonise and he's like, you own what you buy. And I was like, yeah, why not?
Classic. Judd.
Right then, this year's Halloween countdown, King versus King, continues next week with It versus It. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ClashPod. Back on Monday, talking 1990s It. Have a great weekend.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Sometimes the transition to fall and winter feels like experiencing every season on the same day. The shoes in the Allbirds Mizzle collection were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Check off your errands with the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with the Wool Dasher Mizzle, or upgrade to next-level protection with the Wool Runner-Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. allbirds.com, code FRESHSOCKS.